content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. For our first article today, it's actually a conversation between two science journalists, and the title of this is Saturn's Ocean Moon Was Hiding in Plain Sight by Shannon Hall. The outer solar system is awash with liquid water. A briny ocean is concealed beneath the icy crust of Jupiter's fourth largest moon, Europa, with more water than all of the Earth's oceans combined. A subsurface sea on Saturn's moon, Enceladus, spews plumes of water vapor into space. And there are tantalizing hints that oceans could exist on Ganymede, Callisto, Titan, and other distant moons, too. Now, another moon appears to be secretly flooded. Saturn's moon, Mimas, known for its uncanny resemblance to the Death Star in Star Wars, might harbor liquid water beneath its icy shell. If that's true, similar seas could be hiding in plain sight, and the outer solar system may be far more habitable than previously thought. In 2014, astronomers first published evidence that Mimas might be a watery world, submerging the community in decade-long debate. Many, including Alyssa Roden, a planetary scientist now at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado, were highly skeptical of the possibility. Their reasoning was simple. Mimas's heavily cratered surface showed no signs of an internal ocean. As with Enceladus, Saturn's gravity could churn any potential ocean waters within Mimas, causing large cracks to appear in the surface ice. No such features have been seen. The tides might now have turned. Two studies, one by Roden and colleagues, and another by Valerie Launay of the Paris Observatory and colleagues, make a stronger case for an ocean and may even explain the conundrum at the surface. Together, the research suggests that Mimas might have a young and changing ocean. If so, it raises the prospect of an outer solar system rife with activity. That possibility is what most excites Roden, who spoke with Knowable magazine about the potential ocean and why it could be such a boon for scientists. This conversation has been edited for length and clarity. Shannon Hall, what do we know about these hidden oceans? Alyssa Roden, in many ways they look like our own, at least in that they're likely made up of salt water. We know that these ocean worlds have icy surfaces from their overall bright appearance, as confirmed by telescopic and spacecraft measurements, and detect signatures of water ice. Some ocean moons even have low enough densities that they probably have water ice mixed into the rock in their interiors. With heat, that water ice melts into liquid water, which will erode rock and create salt. On Enceladus, salt water is conveniently spewing out into space. Hall, given how cold it is in the outer solar system, what generates the heat? Roden, distant oceans might at first seem out of the question. Heat to melt ice is hard to come by so far from the sun. But thanks to a gravitational quirk, the outer solar system can be quite balmy. Consider Jupiter and its moon Europa. Jupiter exerts a strong gravitational force on Europa, elongating Europa in the direction of Jupiter. Because Europa's orbit is eccentric, it swings close to Jupiter before swinging further away. Europa gets stretched and released over time. This creates friction in the interior that provides the heat necessary to sustain a liquid ocean. We first saw hints that Europa might host a subsurface ocean when the Voyager mission swung past Jupiter in 1979. Europa doesn't look like our moon or even most bodies in the inner solar system. Its icy surface doesn't have a lot of craters, but is instead covered with crisscrossing lines and broken pieces that have shifted around. You don't have to look at it very hard to imagine that something different is going on there. Hall, you mentioned surface features. What other evidence do we rely on to detect a hidden ocean? Roden, one way to look at is to look at magnetic fields. Because salt water is electrically conductive, it can create a magnetic field around the moon that disrupts the planet's magnetic field. That is a leading piece of evidence for Europa's subsurface ocean. But that alone is not enough. It's the combination of evidence that leads us to conclude there's an ocean. We might also consider, for example, measurements of salt on the surface and how the moon's gravity tugs on a spacecraft. Because the densities of rock or liquid metal differ from the density of liquid water, the size of those tugs offers clues to the material, as well as where within the moon it is concentrated. Or we might simply imagine how the moon's face changes direction throughout its orbit. Generally, these small moons always show their same face to their planet parent, much like our moon. But as a moon moves through its orbit, the direction it points can shift a bit back and forth, creating a shimmy in the visual portion. The extent of that shimmy depends on the interior. An ice shell over an ocean can move more freely than an ice shell on top of rock, so the changes tend to be larger. That's how the ocean was detected at Enceladus. And that's one of the best lines of evidence for an ocean at Mimas. Hall, let's talk about Mimas. How did you end up studying this moon? I spent a decade or so working on Europa and other icy moons when the 2014 Mimas paper came out. That paper measured the shimmy or libration as the visible portion of the moon shifts, suggesting Mimas hosted either a subsurface ocean or an oddly shaped core. But an ocean seemed impossible. Mimas looks much like our moon with a heavily cratered surface. It didn't host any crisscrossing lines or broken pieces like Europa. And it certainly wasn't spewing geysers like Enceladus. So I took one look at Mimas and I said, there's no way that that is an ocean moon. Yet I realized I couldn't refute the idea. I kept Mimas in my mind over the years, eventually putting together a paper for the annual review of Earth and Planetary Sciences in 2023. That paper ruled out several ocean scenarios and left only one option, an ocean that formed recently, well after Mimas itself. A young ocean could be stealthy, but it was just a hypothesis. Hall, how has the most recent work changed the picture? Roden, early in 2024, Valéry Lanet and his group reported new observational evidence in favor of an ocean on Mimas. They looked not at the libration, but at changes in Mimas's orbit through time, changes that depend on the interior structure. They found that those changes could not be explained by an oddly shaped core, leaving an ocean as the most viable option. My team's research, published in June, has gone on to explain the lack of visible surface fractures. We argue that the ocean is so young, merely 10 million years old, that it has only recently stopped growing. We think that the tidal stresses of a young churning ocean may not be enough to crack the ice above. Instead, what's needed is the stress that comes from the ocean when the ocean eventually refreezes. Because Mimas is losing heat as its orbit becomes less eccentric over time, refreezing, which is only just beginning on Mimas, will cause the overlaying ice to crack. The research suggests that eventually Mimas is probably going to lose its ocean, which is a little sad since it is just being recognized. But on the flip side, Mimas may become the new Enceladus, the new coolest moon of Saturn, with deep cracks and maybe even jets of water. Hall, what are the big picture implications of this research? Roden, I'm interested in this from a geophysical standpoint. Point. We think of the earliest epochs of our solar system as the hot times when all the activity happens. Then everything evolves towards a quieter state. Pluto's moon Charon might have lost an ocean, and Europa's and Ganymede's oceans are pretty old. That a moon could form a new ocean well into its history, and that we could watch, that's exciting. It opens up the possibility that any world, including one with an old cratered surface, may be going through a similar transition. There's also interest in habitability, whether these oceans are suitable for supporting life. We don't currently know whether any of the solar system's oceans, other than our own, are habitable, have been inhabited, or are currently inhabited. But if Mimas truly has an ocean, we could have a window into how these worlds develop and even how habitats are created and lost. It is exciting to be able to see these processes as they occur, instead of always viewing the end states of things that happened long ago. Hall, what upcoming missions could tell us more? Roden, the European Space Agency already has launched the Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, or JUICE, which will make detailed observations of Europa and the moons Ganymede and Callisto, which show hints of oceans. And in the fall of 2024, NASA will send the Europa Clipper into orbit around Jupiter to determine if Europa has conditions suitable for life. The Uranus system, high on NASA's agenda for a future mission, is where I see the most implications for this recent work. It's surprisingly similar to the Saturn system, including hosting ice-rich, mid-sized moons similar to Mimas and Enceladus. If there's a young ocean on Mimas, it is not a huge leap to consider that water worlds might exist among the Uranian moons, too. Next, a short, fun article by David A. Graham, one of the staff writers of The Atlantic. Doug Emhoff, first jazz fan. Whatever its shortcomings, American society has made two unquestionably great contributions to the world, jazz and constitutional democracy, but the two rarely interact. The typical political attitude toward music is exemplified by Richard Nixon's declaration, "If the music is square, it's because I like it square." Bill Clinton played the saxophone, of course, but his taste veered distressingly into Kenny G territory. Barack Obama paid lip service to jazz, but stuck to basics such as a Love Supreme. Jimmy Carter's ecstatic reaction to the avant-garde pianist Cecil Taylor represents a rare exception to this history of bland musical taste. But you can't question the devotion of Doug Emhoff, the husband of Vice President Kamala Harris. The second gentleman, who might also be called the first jazz fan, is such a devotee that he named his children Ella and Cole for Ella Fitzgerald and John Coltrane, two of his favorite musicians. "It's like the soundtrack of my life," Emhoff told me at an event in Durham, North Carolina, where the Biden campaign was marking Juneteenth, and working to mobilize black voters ahead of the November election. June is also Black Music Month. Emhoff first fell in love with the genre as a kid, perusing the extensive record collection that his father, a real music aficionado, kept. In it, he discovered classic albums such as Coltrane's Giant Steps, Miles Davis's Kind of Blue, and Chet Baker Sings. "If I had more kids, there probably would be a Miles and a Chet, a Betty, and all those things," he said laughingly. Though few political figures enthuse over jazz like Imhoff, scholars of the style have long identified similarities between it and the American form of governance. Jazz music is the perfect metaphor for democracy, Wynton Marsalis, the trumpeter, composer, and educator, has said. We improvise, which is our individual rights and freedoms. We swing, which means we are responsible to nurture the common good for everyone in fine balance. And we play the blues, which means no matter how bad things get, we remain optimistic while still mindful of problems. Imhoff said the metaphor makes sense to him. Jazz isn't constructed, he told me. It's a little messy, like democracy can be at times. Both democracy and jazz privilege listening. So many people, you know, want to shout and beat their chests, and they think that's strength, and they think that that's power. But it's not, Imhoff said. One of the most powerful things that you can do in leadership is listen, and then be able to work together with someone else. So that sounds a lot like jazz. Our third story from the science section. A Giant Deer Fence is Going Up in the American West by Ben Goldfarb. Suburban Utah has become ground zero for deer conservation. Every spring, about 2,000 mule deer traipse through Utah's Cedar Valley, a broad, sage-dotted flatland 40 miles south of Salt Lake City. The herd winters in the Lake Mountains, nibbling sagebrush and other forage, and summers around the Oquirrs, whose green shoulders jut from the valley floor in the north, The animals commute between the ranges via two general routes, following washes and ridge lines and their own ancestors' trails. They have likely made this journey for centuries, perhaps millennia. The culture of migration passed through the generations like language. Modern obstacles now threaten this timeless trek. The herd's passage takes it through Eagle Mountain, more than 50 square miles of sprawling exurb, composed mostly of subdivisions layered atop former ranch lands. Since its incorporation in 1996, Eagle Mountain has exploded from just 250 lonely souls to more than 50,000. It's now on track to surpass 150,000 by 2060, making it one of the fastest-growing cities in Utah. As Eagle Mountain has grown, its deer have suffered. Subdivisions are encroaching on their habitat, and traffic kills about 100 every year. It's a common crisis in the West, where in 2016, researchers calculated that a football field of open space succumbs to development every 2.5 minutes. Mule deer are among the victims of this creeping habitat loss. Wyoming's herd has declined by nearly half over the past three decades. In western Colorado, researchers have found that residential development is worse for fawn survival than energy development. In housing humans, we evict deer. Eagle Mountain is aware of the problem. Few western municipalities have done more to incorporate ungulate movement in their planning. Prodded by a scrappy local group called the Eagle Mountain Nature and Wildlife Alliance, the city has written deer-friendly ordinances into its zoning codes, negotiated conservation deals with would-be buyers, and, most ambitious of all, sought to permanently protect the herd's narrow migration corridor. When this started, the mayor said it was a dream. Bettina Cameron, the alliance's director, told me, "We've overcome so many obstacles." These efforts have attracted notice. So many towns are retroactively trying to fix situations like this, and to get out in front before development fills it in too much is a neat concept, says Matt Howard, the natural resource manager at Utah Department of Transportation. Whether Eagle Mountain can continue to grow without sacrificing its most charismatic fauna, however, is far from certain. The stakes are high. If the city succeeds, it could provide a blueprint for other Western towns trying to strike their own precarious balance between development and conservation. If it fails, the deer will suffer the consequences. One spring morning, I drove to Eagle Mountain to see the corridor for myself. I joined a group that included Cameron, Mayor Tom Westmoreland, and the municipal wildlife biologist Todd Black. We headed up a promontory called Turtle Hill for a bird's-eye view of the city. Cul-de-sacs, pickups in driveways, vivid emerald lawns. Million-dollar homes sat next to tumbleweed-strewn lots. Cameron gestured toward a wide swath of undeveloped land owned by a patchwork of state agencies and private developers, and explained that it was slated for large residential developments serviced by a new highway. "This is going to have 4,500 homes on it," she said. Cameron is part of the city's rapid growth. A former member of New York's Air National Guard, she moved to Utah in 2008, seeking open space. She and her husband came to Eagle Mountain in 2018, the same year Utah Division of Wildlife Resources began fitting mule deer with satellite tracking collars, documenting the routes by which they meander through town. A year later, Cameron read about the state's research, recalled the deer that roamed seasonally across her own 5 acres, and realized she'd inadvertently bought property near a migration route. She and like-minded neighbors formed the alliance and began urging the city to protect deer movement. "We started looking at county maps and saying, 'Okay, where can they go?'" she recalled. At first, it seemed hopeless. Valuable lots pressed against the migration route everywhere, and a maze of highways and residential roads fractured the corridor. Nevertheless, the alliance found a relatively receptive audience in city government. In 2018, Eagle Mountain banned construction along ridgelines and seasonal washes, part of a broader effort to keep a third of the city as open space. "We're trying to create something unique and not just another urbanized development," Mayor Westmoreland said. "If we can have an equal amount of land dedicated to outdoor recreation and wildlife, that just seems like a pretty ideal place to live." In 2021, the city hired Black, a research scientist who'd spent his career studying deer movements at Utah State University, making Eagle Mountain among the only Western cities where a municipal wildlife biologist. Black knew the deer wandered into subdivisions seeking ornamental plantings and gardens, running into conflict with landowners and cars. If too many deer strayed, the migration would dissolve. He and others began to design a large chute composed of more than 20 miles of 8-foot-high fencing that will someday guide deer through Eagle Mountain. Around dense subdivisions, the funnel will narrow to about 330 feet to hustle deer through. In other places, it will expand to give them space to rest and feed. Wildlife corridors are often abstract, loosely defined pathways, but Eagle Mountains will, in theory, be a piece of solid infrastructure. "I tell everyone to picture a mule deer luge that runs through the city," Black said. The deer luge is years from completion as Eagle Mountain cobbles together funding from the Mule Deer Foundation and other sources. In partnership with the state, though, the city has already installed some crucial components, such as a stretch of deer-proof fencing along State Route 73, a historic collision zone, and a gap in the fence where the corridor bisects the highway. A roadside infrared detector flashes an alert to drivers whenever deer approach. Eventually, the warning system will be replaced by an underpass, one of nearly a dozen proposed wildlife passages. In the meantime, highway roadkill numbers have already plummeted, Black said. At times, the corridor's infrastructure struck me as almost surreally proactive. From Highway 73, we drove to the foot of an adjacent hill, where an 8-foot fence cleaved the brush. On one side of it, Black explained, the land was protected by conservation easements and would remain deer habitat in perpetuity. On the other, a development agreement ensured that houses and residential roads would eventually bloom. Earlier, Black had averred that the city was trying to put the horse before the cart, and this preemptive fence seemed to epitomize that philosophy. The barrier ran like a zipper across the land, dividing nothing from nothing, waiting patiently for the subdivision that would justify its existence. That subdivision and more are coming. In Eagle Mountain, signs advertised growth around every bend. Master plan communities, we buy land, lots available, new homes, new builds, now selling. A Tyson Foods billboard thanked locals for welcoming the company's new beef and pork plant. Meta had opened a data center, and Google planned to follow suit. As Eagle Mountain grows, deer will shape its expansion. The city's transportation plan requires wildlife crossings for new roads along the migration route, and its planning code includes wildlife corridor overlay zones, stretches of habitat where developers must install animal-friendly fencing, minimize artificial lighting, avoid construction during deer migration and bird nesting seasons, and abide by other restrictions. Along the herd's most crucial migration pathways, development is almost entirely prescribed. Of course, it's one thing to protect deer on paper and another to foster private land conservation during a real estate boom. Both the city and the alliance are leery of infringing on property rights, which many Utahns consider sacrosanct. As Black put it, the last thing I want is for it to be a take. The city prefers to deploy carrots rather than sticks, courting landowners, many of whom have generations-deep roots in the valley, and offering conservation incentives. One developer donated 55 acres to the city just before her death. Others have agreed to density transfers, ceding land within the corridor in exchange for permission to build houses with smaller road frontages or squeezing more homes into other developments. None of the developers contacted for this story responded to a request for comment. Not everyone is eager to accommodate ungulates. The city has also been forced to make concessions to builders, including in some cases amending the proposed deer luge by routing animals as much as a quarter mile from their habitual trails. If we can make it look as comfortable as we can to them, I think it's going to work, Jeremy Anderson, the Utah Regional Director for the Mule Deer Foundation, told me. Nonetheless, it's a suggestion that wildlife must still compete with development. I'm always afraid that I'm going to miss something that's going to destroy this corridor, Cameron said. And some of the project's toughest challenges still loom. At one point, we passed two undeveloped parcels, totaling 320 acres, owned by Utah's most powerful force, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They're the only landowner I haven't had the opportunity to sit down with yet, Black said carefully. Eagle Mountain's plan represents a different and creative narrative, one in which humans made space, however circumscribed, for wild creatures. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.